forget the first moment when I walked in Kyo Cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the 13th Revamped Scanon Podcast, discussing this week in Irish international film. I'm Darren, and joining me are...
Roman.
Hi, Jay.
So, before we jump into the week in film news, we'll talk a little bit about what we watched this week. Jay?
Okay, let's start with Jay.
Putting you in the hot seat, Jay.
We always like to
start with Jay. Alright, we got a couple.
We're going alphabetically.
I watched one of the Oscar-nominated documentaries, Strong Island.
Okay.
Which is on Netflix. It's a Jens Ford film about the murder of his brother, which was kind of... There's footage around it, but it's kind of made years later as a kind of a... Kind of like... if either of you seen Cara Morley's Dreams of a Life.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not quite as good as that. So don't get your hopes too much. But what it does do, it kind of creates something out of the absence of someone.
Right.
You know, this kind of thing where there's a collage of kind of...
It's Dreams of a Life about the woman who lived
in London.
She was found in dead
for about 3 years. Just
so repaired.
Yeah, because that's the kind of social alienation kind of.
And
that irony of being lost in the middle of
a gigantic city.
Yeah. Now, it's not the same story at all in that regard, but what it is it's people trying to piece together somebody's life in the vacuum of his absence, essentially, and how it's affected him and kind of things like that. And has kind of like diary entries, interviews, kind of really close-up shots of old ID cards, which look like something from the 80s now. You know, where you kind of curl and the plastic kind of goes. So it has this kind of...
flakes.
Yeah, the kind of, and it has that kind of... It's a real texture. Kind of... And it gives the visual kind of representation of what's happened. This was frozen in time at that point, you know, that kind of way. It has things like really personal interviews with like friends and family members. And it's trying to get at what is a life, I guess, in that sense of what do we mean and what... Are you the person you are because he died? Would you be still the person you are now? Would you be like this if he had lived? That kind of thing. So it's aiming really high in that regard, trying to get at something kind of profound. It mostly kind of gets there, but it kind of gets a little scattered in the second half, so it kind of robs of a little bit of its power. But very impressive filmmaking, and very intensely personal, which I was liking the documentary in the sense of, I like something that's personal, that's kind of brought something, it brings something to it, a kind of an intensity. And I'd recommend it. It's like, it's not... The greatest documentary I've seen in years now, even though it's kind of had a strong reputation for it, but it's really good.
For Strong Island?
Not for nothing do I learn from you, Darren. But what we're seeing, it's pretty good. You should see it. It's one of the kind of decent documentaries, and Netflix are pretty good for documentaries. They generally kind of kind of acquire really good ones. Like, they're generally a bit better than... The original films, like, for example, they have the better quality kind of documentaries.
Yeah. And they also give them a wider platform as well. Like, it's hard to imagine some of the documentaries that have done so well on Netflix doing... Like, there's the recent one about the cult, for example, was it in Jersey?
Oh, the West Country or...
Yeah, West...
Bell Country or something. Yeah, another one you're talking
about,
which I haven't watched yet.
But the attention that garnered due to being on Netflix, which is remarkable, and I don't think it would have garnered otherwise.
And it's really interesting. There isn't necessarily an objection to people watching documentary on Netflix, whereas they'll very rarely journey to the cinema to see a documentary, because I suppose there's a perception that you go to the cinema for spectacle, and
documentary I think there's an unfair kind of thing on documentary that's... Documentary is just like watching real life. You can watch that on TV at home. Yeah. Why would you go to the cinema to watch it?
I can watch that out my window.
Yeah, exactly. But generally, it's like if something's an hour and 30 minutes, like on Channel 4 with Louis Theroux, why would you go to the cinema to see X? I think that's still a proper documentary.
I mean, even in End of Year List, not on the Scanon End of Year List, because I know you've included documentaries.
I do. And
you've
pretty much every year
Lemonade,
pretty high,
for example, as well.
Yeah.
So we're fairly flexible in that regard. We're no Cahiers de Cinema listing David Lynch's Twin Peaks. But in other top 10 lists or on other lists, there's generally a tendency to divorce documentaries from narrative films, for example.
Well, I know, I can't remember which film, anything, because this came up again with the Twin Peaks being included on various lists at the end of the year. Somebody made a point that, I can't remember which film critic in the 80s put it like one of the matches of the World Series baseball into his top 10 of the year, which I kind of really like.
I mean,
obviously it doesn't belong there, but my God, I admire it.
That
is pre-Twitter where people talk about this. This is like the 1980s, right?
Today.
Oh, the whole match of the
letters he got.
But that was kind of amazing. I kind of remember that.
That's
I must look it up.
Lists, the Super Bowl at the best.
Yeah, but that's exactly it. Like, and that's it. Why not? I mean, where's the line if you're gonna?
Yeah.
Anyway, that was just kind of made me laugh. But worth looking up. Another watch was I watched another Netflix film, Sun Dogs, which is a pretty new Netflix film. It's one they've acquired. Directed by Jennifer Morrison, if anybody remembers House, the TV show.
She was an actress there.
And she's a very good actress and very good in that. And this is her kind of directorial debut. And it's kind of a weird little indie story about this guy who had like that. Like, it kind of infers what happened, and it kind of makes it a little more explicit later on. But there's kind of an issue at birth where he's a little kind of not quite all there. He's just kind of mental problems and difficulties. But this is kind of set in 2004, where every year he goes to try to sign up for the Marines post 9/11. He wants to fight the terrorists and stuff. Like, so he turns up, rocks up, and the Marines kind of say, like, I want to sign up and whatever. And eventually, after 3 years of this, there's a new guy there, and he kind of gives him this kind of fake operation just to kind of keep him out of the hair, saying, no, you can't go abroad to fighting soldiers, but you can be a special operative at home, you know, trying to find stuff. And he takes this, of course, literally, and starts following kind of co-workers
who are
Middle Eastern. So it's got this kind of creepy, sad, lonely weirdness to it, which is quite nice in terms of it's kind of, the tone is quite done very well. And certainly for the, 50 minutes or an hour, it's kind of solidly kind of odd in a way. Now, it has that kind of quirky Sundance indie vibe off a little bit, which always irks me. You know the ones, you know what I'm talking about, Darren.
Yes, having watched Me and Earl the Dying Girl.
There's a Sundance indie thing that comes off a lot of films, particularly in the kind of American independent cinema kind of movement, that they all have a kind of slightly generic kind of look and feel.
But a slightly generic look and feel that's designed to seem amateurish in contrast to a more slick production.
Yeah.
But it's an effect rather than a genuine thing. Like, you get a sense that they could, if they put the effort in, look more professional, but not looking professional.
It all comes out of Little Miss Sunshine, mostly trying to replicate the success of that.
I don't know what the film was. To do with a brother and sister with...
The Skeleton Twins.
Yes. You've heard the song bit in
really
that?
Enjoyed
I didn't. Oh. But
really?
I'll tell you why. Then it's that kind of bit where he lip syncs to the, which is designed only, as far as I can see, to appeal to the people that like Sundance films with those scenes in them. But I can see what I like two actors in it, and I like a lot about it.
It's the kind of situation.
But there's that affectation that these kind of American indie films.
You can imagine
them
there shooting it, being like, okay, so we're going to premiere at Sundance,
and we need something to talk about.
Plan is to ride it all the way to the Oscars, baby.
And the thing about the film Sundance is there's a bit at the end that has that, and I'm not saying everybody should go and watch it. It's not a bad film. It kind of slips away. The controls kind of slips away a little bit towards the end.
It's a bit rough.
Indeed. Yes. But it's a fascinating film. As a kind of debut, I've seen worse, and it, like, there's a lot to recommend in it.
And it has
Alison Janney and Ed O'Neill as parents,
which always helps.
A bonus. Like,
but Ed O'Neill, nice.
Yeah. But
I actually like when I get to see Ed O'Neill act, because it's astounding. An entire generation of people seem to have missed the memo that he's actually a really good dramatic actor.
Yeah.
Obviously, owing to Married with Children and Modern Family.
And he still lives at home, and he sits around watching kind of the Deer Hunter and Platoon and stuff. That's where the Americans get that war kind of imagery and ideas from. But it's not bad. It's not great, but it has certain things to recommend it, so I kind of somewhat recommend it. But be wary of that indie American thing. So one more before I finish. Morphin Collar, which is the Lynn Ramsey film, which I was convinced I'd seen but hadn't seen.
It has that way of worming its way into your brain even before you get to it.
Into Jay's head.
I reevaluated We Need to Talk with Kevin because it's amazing, and I was a really mistaken the first time I saw it. You Were Never Really Here is great. So I said, I'll go back and rewatch this, or as it turns out, watch this. And like a lot of romantic films, it's like 90 minutes long, extremely lean. There's not an ounce of fat on her films. Like, she knows exactly what she wants to put out there. And this film is like, it's visceral, it's visual, astounding kind of sound design and soundtrack that actually kind of paces the film. The songs punctuate at certain points, the music punctuates, the sound design, the kind of view you get from Samantha Morton, whose face is camera adores. Like, she's an incredible face, an incredible actress. And it's a really dark, weird, impressionistic, kind of strange film. Like, that has this kind of it's tightly controlled pacing, but it seems like it could go out of control at any moment. Like, it's that kind of, when you're a really good editor and a really good filmmaker and you know exactly what you're doing, you can make something that's clearly planned out look like anything can happen at any given point, and that's an extraordinary skill, I think, and very few filmmakers, I think, have that work today. Like, she's one of the best filmmakers there is.
It's got an incredible balance of tone, because it effectively starts with the lead character spooning a corpse, which is a really tough way to begin a film.
And you see,
there's something comic about it, and her reaction to her situation is very strange at times. You know, she doesn't seem all too perturbed by it.
No.
But there's also a real sense of loss there.
And an interior kind of loss. Like, that's kind of cheeky.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
and Morton is so good at communicating that wordlessly.
Yeah, exactly. And it has this thing as well, which it's kind of funny.
Oh, it is. It's really funny, especially when they go to Spain.
Yeah. But even at the start, where you were mentioned, like, she's kind of lying to the corpse, right? Initially, it kind of close up in her face at the start of the film, and it's kind of dark independent cinema thing of the light going on and off, and you think it's some sort of weird dark kind of thing, but it's just Christmas tree lights across the room, and that's a really funny but brilliantly used, aware of the trope of that kind of thing, but having an actual reason for it, which is actually really good, and made me actually guff off watching it. Like,
the use of lighting in that film is incredible. Uh-huh. There's a later scene where she's lying in bed, and Lynn Ramsey doesn't like to have excessive displays of emotion. She likes to kind of indicate towards the emotion that's pent up inside. Yeah. And there's just one shot that I always remember where it's raining outside, and the silhouette of
the rain looks like
coming across her face.
It's incredible.
Beautiful.
And it comes down at little angles and little soft little trails. It's
absolutely
beautiful.
Gorgeous. It's suggestive. You know, it doesn't have one of those awful scenes where a character breaks down.
No. And it doesn't need it.
Yeah,
but most filmmakers miss that you don't need things. It's kind of cut away the kind of extemporaneous stuff that doesn't really matter to get to the heart of the story. It's incredible. It's an incredible film. She's one of the best filmmakers, honestly. She's just...
How does it stack up to the movies on your mind?
It seems similar.
You were able to imagine that from the page. I'm
a very visual person.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you want the next Lynn Ramsey, just give Jay something like $20 million.
I'll visualize the bar, she can knock it out of the bar.
They showed it at the IFI recently on 35.
I was really annoyed and missed it.
The only print they could source was, I think it had Norwegian subtitles.
So yeah. It's probably added nice
kind
to the
nice
kind of
to see you when you get these things. Yeah. That they've gone to such lengths.
Also, I really like that.
There's something really nice
to the strangeness as well.
Can imagine all the Norwegian people who feasted on this particular print in the past.
I love that. I really wanted to see that, especially where you just went to guns. But anyway, that is my week.
Your week in film.
Yes.
Ronan.
I saw quite a lot this week, so I'll sort of try to quickly run through things. Saturday night, saw BPM, new release that hasn't made it into the top 10, unfortunately, but it's great. Everybody go see it.
I will be seeing it, hopefully, when I come back from being away, but it's on my list.
It's really, really good. As
good
I said last week.
You've seen it already,
Yeah. So I saw it a couple of months back. Because it's only been released now in the last week, I'm counting it as my favourite film of this year, and it stacks up. It's really great, really funny. I saw it on Saturday night with an ACT UP Dublin screening that was sold out. Really great, like the perfect crowd for it. There was a great reaction to it, spontaneous applause at various points. It goes down very, very well with a big crowd. Can't recommend it enough. I'm really impressed by it. And second viewing, there were parts of it that I kind of caught that I hadn't noticed before.
Always a good sign of film.
Yeah, absolutely. It's nuanced that way, and the kind of relationships that are happening between the main characters and also peripheral characters, because it's quite a large ensemble. It really adds to it. So I can't recommend that one enough.
You've sold me. I'm definitely going to get to see it. I guess I'll have it for another week or two.
One thing I love about it is that despite the tragedy of it, it's quite jubilant, which is why I really like that they scheduled it as a sort of party thing, that they had a party in the IFI afterwards. And it was, it creates a great atmosphere of, despite the terrible things that happen in this film,
you've
enjoy life.
Before in terms of the kind of tragic gay story.
Absolutely. And it's absolutely refusing to indulge in that sort of thing. So that made for a very, very good Saturday night and a slightly hungover Sunday morning, which meant I went and rested in the arms of Keddie. One of my favourite films from last year, the Istanbul Stray Cat documentary.
Yet to see this.
Oh my god, Jay.
I don't like cats,
is it perfect?
It's perfect.
Stop.
It's beyond.
Stop.
I'm really feline this.
Oh,
no. But I heard it's great. Yeah.
I would be interested to know your response as somebody who doesn't like cats. Now, I have to say, I have a complete thing about cats. If you put a cat in front of me, I will lose my
wife loves cats, so I'll pitch it like... in that regard.
But it's, I think you would really like it because it's not just a really cutesy cat city film. What it is it's one of these classic, like they used to do it in silent cinema all the time, the City Symphony, where you get the impression of a city from these kind of quick cut perspectives on it across various things, and they follow it something like a dozen cats. But they built special rigs. Yeah, they built special cameras and they follow them down sewers, go all around the city, and Istanbul has this strange thing where there are so many stray cats. But they follow these dozen or so cat characters, and they all have names. They talk to people in the city who see them every day, and there are these amazing scenes where there's somebody who works in a cafe and says things like, "Oh, Gaston will come up and knock on my door for a bit of chicken. He doesn't like turkey, but he only likes chicken." Stuff like this.
It's really
funny, really sweet, beautifully shot with all these special rigs they have. But it really creates this amazing idea of what composes a city. You know, the relationship between all the various species in this case that sharing it, and it really builds an amazing portrait of Istanbul. And I am about to sell it to you very well. It's under 90 minutes.
So I actually didn't mean to catch it. People loved it. That scene. I kind of go, all right. I mean,
sounds like it'll be catnip for Jane.
Indeed. Yes. I do want to see it. And kind of mentioned it, that kind of city thing. I remember the Terence Davis of Time, the City of Liverpool, that pulls into all the various. It's great though, and pulls into all various strands and wonderful kind of almost sarcastic voiceover kind of thing.
It's so dry. But that idea that a city is so many things to so many different people.
Various different aspects. I like that.
And it gets at that idea of what is a city, what is the relationship between people or cats, and through that, what are cats, what are humans, all these grand questions. It's really
all right, you've sold me. Sold.
A couple of other things I'll quickly fly through. La Soledad is a Venezuelan film I saw. I hadn't either. It was on Mubi and it's now expired,
Also, my Mubi subscription is finished.
Mine has now expired. I'm going to renew it though, because I keep doing that thing where I see interesting things like this and quickly watch them, but I always watch them, you know, just as they're about to expire. So I tell people, and they've already gone. But La Soledad is really interesting. I think based on the kind of the economic circumstance in Venezuela at the moment, it's astonishing to get a film made, let alone one this good. It's really, really good. It has some of those sort of Latin American tropes that you see in a lot of their cinema, where there is a sort of grand country house as a metaphor for the country at large, and it's inevitable that you'd look at this film as a metaphor for what's going on in the country. Story is basically a lower class family who are working in the mother works as a maid for a rich household, and they've been living in their country home, and they're told they have to get out. They have nowhere else to go. They're fleeing the country en masse, as is pretty much everyone else. There are these great scenes that have a documentary kind of energy about them, of people fleeing the country, and amazing shots of supermarkets with one loaf of bread on the shelf. It really communicates a great sense of how bad things are in Venezuela at the moment. But the narrative is kind of quite symbolic and opaque. The main character is trying to find... He's heard these legends of rich people who've buried things in old houses on the grounds of them, and he's sort of traipsing about with a metal detector, and there are all sorts of slightly on-the-nose symbolic aspects to it. But I was really impressed with it, and I have to say, I don't have a huge experience with Venezuelan cinema, so it's great to get that exposure.
I don't know if you saw the Irish documentary from years back where the guy is... I think it's called This Revolution Will Not Be Televised. It's an Irish, I can't remember the documentary filmmaker's name. I've seen the film, and it'll come back to me. But basically, they were in Venezuela filming when Chavez was coming to power, right? Okay. I was in power. Yep. And that was they accidentally were in a coup situation.
Yeah.
So they're filming from inside a coup. It's extraordinary, because it kind of almost bookends what you're talking about in terms of the promise that the Chavez years were going to bring, and where we are now, and that documentary kind of...
Directed by Kim Bartley and Donica O'Brien.
That's right. It's
starring Hugo Chavez.
It's one of the best stories.
I love when Google tries to
make it seem like a narrative.
To fit to a template. It's starring Hugo Chavez.
It's great. It's one of the best, almost, I won't say accidental documentaries, I'm sure the documentary that you were planning on making
would have been good, interesting.
But they actually fall into
the right place.
The state takes over the TV channels, and then there's protests and everything. It's really amazing.
And
amazing,
it's really difficult to work that well when you have one film in mind, something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. To readjust you your own, very yeah. well.
And you're editing as it's happening.
I think you know it's gold exactly. mine stuff, though. You know yeah. you're in like pure look kind of territory. And I'm sure it wasn't looking, they might be killed or something. You know, yeah. Who knows how these things will go. But in terms of documentary, it's well worth getting to see. And it just, as again mentioned, it kind of feels like a bookend to the kind of the other end of the kind of the dream of the kind of socialist kind of ideal that didn't come to pass the last.
Yeah. Yeah.
Went badly wrong.
Just two other standouts for me then. I saw Behemoth, which is a Chinese documentary about industrialization and mines in Inner Mongolia. They're extracting various natural resources, and it is beautifully shot there. These incredible landscapes that are just completely, you know, decimated, and it's just black.
Probably alien kind of vibe.
Yeah, yeah, it's bizarre. They have the extreme wide lenses all the time, and it looks so bizarre, and it's contrasted with natural beauty, but it gets really up and close with the toil it's extracted on human lives. And then in the third segment of the film, it shifts to these ghost cities that they have in China. We have ghost estates here. They have ghost cities. Jeez. Apparently, okay. there are something close to 1,000 of them, where they're just cities.
Cities completely empty.
Completely empty. High
rate. Completely empty. Like, yeah. Would you not have had people move in? Or
well, the film doesn't. It's kind of summed up in a little title card near the end, but it tracks through one with the camera.
And people going into mega cities then, kind of thing, abandoning kind of small.
They don't spend much of the film focusing on. Oh, yeah, I think that's the case. Yeah, yeah. They have these small, like, commuter cities, as it were, in China. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, now that you mentioned mega cities, we're all just imagining. It's just one title card at the end of the film.
Judge Dredd. Yeah.
But it's really visually astonishing, and it does this thing where it tries to kind of bring a poetry to it, where it has this sort of symbolic naked figure who keeps appearing in these massive landscapes to kind of contrast the wages of human industry with the human cost. Absolutely, it works very, very well. I have to say, I think it's a fantastic film. It overdoes it at points, but it's absolutely worth checking out if you can find it.
That was shown on film four
a while back. I had it recorded. They seem to do that. And the one other thing I wanted to highlight, this is a movie that has expired, but I was so smitten with it that I cannot mention it. The Immortal Story, the Orson Welles film, which I wasn't at all familiar with.
No, I think I've heard the name, but I certainly haven't seen it.
It's 60 minutes, which is great.
Oh my god, let's just leave. Let's just abandon the podcast.
Jay's on the floor. It's absolutely wonderful. It's the basic story is that, and I love this thing about Welles, where progressively throughout his career he understood his own image. He plays a merchant who is completely reclusive, and you know he's suffering from gout, and he's,
which is probably not true to life.
Orson Welles spends almost, in fact, does he? Yeah, yeah, he spends sitting almost down. The entire film in one chair. He gets up and goes into a little carriage for a while. But the basic idea is that he is a very, very rich merchant who has terrible gout and can't sleep. So he gets his accountant to read him account books at night to try to tire him out. And says at one point, surely there must be other kinds of books. And the accountant is like, well, yeah, books, like stories. So tells him, Orson Welles tells him a story. About a sailor who...
So this is actually like Arabian Nights, basically, with Orson Welles, what I'm getting from this concept.
They share this story. The Orson Welles character shares this story about a sailor who was invited back to the house of a rich merchant and had an erotic encounter with a woman, and the accountant interrupts him to say, I've heard that story. Sailors always tell it to each other. That's one of the old stories. And Orson Welles is furious. He's like, you mean it's not even real? Well, then we're going to make it happen. So he goes and tries to organise with this accountant to find a sailor and bring him back to have an erotic encounter in his house.
It's almost like referencing film.
Exactly what it's doing. Yeah. It's an adaptation of a novel, and it's very strange. Like as you'd expect from Welles, it's got this really playful aesthetic. It's constantly, the way characters are framed in relation to each other, the blocking is absolutely terrific, and it's got this strangely self-conscious voiceover from Welles himself. That is a little bit typical bad adaptation narration, but it knows it's doing that. It's being very playful. It's extremely self-aware. It's very, very playful. It's absolutely hilarious. I'm really blown away by it.
Oh man, I gotta see this. It sounds amazing.
They play out this story that the Welles character is really keen to have. And it concludes in this amazing sex scene that's just fantastically shot.
And Jay is like, if I wasn't so before.
60-minute film that concludes with a sex scene and Orson Welles.
Well, it doesn't quite conclude there, but I would say climax is there. It really is an absolutely terrific film, and I was so impressed by it.
All right.
Well, I suppose you'd expect to be impressed by Wells, but I'm surprised it doesn't have more of a reputation, to be honest.
Ah, okay.
I suspect we'll be talking about Wells when we get to the news.
He may come up again.
It's a rich well upon which we might draw. I didn't watch that many films last week, so I mostly dipped into watching popular comfort films. So I watched, for example, Kurosawa's most popular film in Japan, Yojimbo, which is great. Rewatch. Fantastic film. His third film shot in widescreen, actually.
Oh,
that's astounding. It's somewhat underrated when you compare it to stuff like Rashomon or Seven Samurai or whatever, but obviously massively influential in terms of everything from, you know, Fistful of Dollars through to Last Man Standing, the greatest film of the 90s, if we're being entirely honest.
That's a Walter Hill film, isn't it?
That is
with Bruce Willis.
With Bruce Willis and Christopher Walken.
It's pretty good, aren't it? I saw it in the cinema when it came out. That regards cinema release, in case anybody forgets.
You mean a Bruce Willis film in the 90s got a cinema release?
No, I mean, this was not expected to get a cinema release. But I quite liked it. Not as darn, it's actually interesting.
I haven't seen that one at all.
Pretty bad.
It's been 20 years now.
I know. There is also apparently a version of Yojimbo in which Rutger Hauer navigates between cyborgs and aliens, and I'm kind of like, I want to track that.
I thought you meant literally like an alternate version Kurosawa had shot.
Oh, it's Rutger Hauer.
Wow.
But a version of the Yojimbo tale, and I kind of want to see with Rutger Hauer manipulating aliens and cyborgs. It sounds amazing and terrible.
Just, I really hope Ridley Scott didn't direct it.
Because it sounds like a Ridley Scott film, doesn't it? What was it? It was the Warrior and the Sorceress, which was the Roger Corman one as well, I believe. Which is the source of the
I do
whole,
love Corman.
Yeah.
Fun. He's battling for his legacy now or something.
He is. Apparently he's tied up in some sort of horrible battle
with his sons.
It's quite similar to the Stan Lee situation where you have the children, I believe, who are apparently exploiting him. Now, these are children who are like 60, 70
years
old.
I thought he'd be dead by now kind of thing.
They're all waiting
and controlling and cutting him off and wheeling him out. Like, Stan Lee had the big expose in the Hollywood Reporter where he was being wheeled out at conventions charging $100 to do a signing for 9 hours a day for 3 days and a weekend, 95 years old, which is horrific.
I remember reading this various things about Howard Hughes and that kind of things happening in the 70s, like in Vegas. And you'd think with the advent of kind of knowledge and the fact that Stanley turns up Marvel films and stuff, that people would be more aware and would be able to stop this kind of thing.
Apparently he did reach out to his lawyer to try and stop it, but his family estate used their power of attorney to fire the lawyer. Like, it's apparently really, really bitter.
Jesus.
That's
grim.
So, yeah, on less grim note, I also watched, because it was on and because I couldn't turn it off, Jurassic Park. Because, there's a monster movie this week, and last week there was also a Steven Spielberg film. So I feel like Jurassic Park was worth watching.
It's the perfect bridge.
It really is, between the two. Fantastic. Great thing about it is the hiring of B-movie actors. It's like, one of the things I really, really like about it, and I think is underrated, is the fact that it's effectively a Spielberg film constructed out of B-movie actors. You have Sam Neill, whose biggest role to date was like The Omen 3 or Dead Calm. You have, obviously, Go
In the Mouth of Madness.
In the Mouth of Madness is horribly underseen. We both love it.
It's a brilliant
film. It's a fantastic film. John Carpenter's one of the great Lovecraft
adaptations. One of the first my discoveries of last year. Yeah. I couldn't believe how good it was.
Wow. Yeah.
You would love it.
It's
really
great. It is one of the best Lovecraft adaptations I've ever seen.
Whoa.
It's remarkable.
It's so great.
It's so great.
I was like, it's one of those things, once I'd watched it, I was like, why did I wait so many years to watch this in my life? For years. It is incredible.
Wow. That's happened this weekend.
I mean, top tier Carpenter. Like, it's amazing.
It is very, very worth seeking out if you get the opportunity.
But anyway, sorry, go on.
But no, and then obviously Goldblum from The Fly and Dern, who was working with Lynch.
It's a great cast. Like, you're right, it is a great cast.
It's a fantastic cast. It's a completely atypical blockbuster cast, even by the standards of the time, particularly in the 90s, where you were building blockbusters around recognizable stars, like, for example, obviously Cruise or Smith or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It was kind of interesting to see a blockbuster that was literally, the star is the spectacle.
And I agree with you, and the spectacle is star, and the thing of it as well, once you have actors that are obviously familiar, but they're not. That doesn't mean any of them
they
couldn't
don't
die.
Yeah.
So it does make a difference when there's dinosaurs chasing them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Goldblum in theory could have been bitten in half, or
Goldblum was almost written out of the film. Apparently,
but then he realized it was Goldblum.
That's exactly.
They saw
apparently. We're not doing that.
Spielberg apparently met with Goldblum and was like, "No,
we're not doing that."
And then finally, because another because it was on, I watched The Prestige, which is one of the best films of the 21st century. wonderful rumination upon everything from capitalism to religion to storytelling.
I have not seen this one. It's the only Nolan I haven't seen, yeah.
I've got many things to say about the Prestige.
Jay and I were talking about it just recently, and I mentioned it's the only one I haven't seen. I think you said it's the worst.
No, it's not the worst. Following is the worst, but it's
considerable.
Following is the worst, yeah.
It's the second worst.
Really?
If not the third worst. It's down there with a couple of others.
It's up there with the worst.
It's fantastic.
But I'm very, very aware I'm in the 1% of people that think this.
I am not at all surprised at the sides you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm not at all surprised that Darren Crowbar didn't have Nolan film either. But anyway,
I watched it.
Fine. If I really don't like, say, Insomnia and The Dark Knight Rises, but quite admire rather than like Interstellar, and quite like The Dark Knight, where will it fall for me?
Probably quite like it. How do you like Memento?
Yeah, I'm okay with Memento.
Should do quite well.
How do you like Nolan? Yeah. It's a real question here, isn't it? All right.
I'm not big on Nolan.
Enjoy. Yeah. It has Bowie in it, though. I mean, that's
Bowie slaying Tesla. Right?
Bowie playing a rock star, introduced walking across a stage as electric sparks dazzle the audience. Come on, tell me.
It's the best part of the film.
There's also an infinite number of cats.
Oh.
And you're sold.
He's done it.
Yeah, that's it. Boom.
I can't even.
There's no resistance anymore. It's fantastic. But yeah.
See you later.
See you later. Cool. So let's move on to talking about the news. Myself and Jay and Ronan, while we have him not watching a movie featuring infinite cats. The big news this week was the Irish government pledging $200 million to Ireland's media production and audiovisual industries as
Which
part
is
of their...
very good to see. It's very, very welcome.
It is in many ways.
Yeah.
Apparently the finances will reach the pre-recession levels in 2021, I believe. So we're not even there yet.
It's better news. I mean, you would think that, the cost of production is going up, that reaching levels of 11 years ago or whatever is probably not
the highest we should be
going, but it's better than nothing, I guess.
It's a long time to get over a gutting, I suppose.
True.
It really is. And I mean, what's interesting, though, about it is that it generated, actual massive coverage abroad.
Yeah,
like the Hollywood
Variety and stuff.
Because
the Irish film industry is such a big deal.
Yeah, where we are now, because it was obviously citing Brooklyn, and it was also citing Vikings and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's always interesting to see news that is huge to us, obviously, making an impression overseas. But yeah, the plan is basically to phase it in over a period of, I think, is it 10 years?
10 years, yeah. And with so 20 million here.
My only kind of caveat on that would be that doesn't change that it. It's like ring fence or something,
change with the
if things go down a little bit in the economy, then all of a sudden where does the money come from to go towards something else? And
it also includes a €40 million program investing in cultural infrastructure across all regions, so they'll see regional arts centers, theaters, museums, galleries, archives, multi-use facilities, and artisanal studios as well.
Although the ones they're pointing out in that, it's extremely heavily Dublin based. The only one I saw in the list that was mainly being touted was the Crawford Gallery in Cork. It was the only one outside Dublin that I saw explicitly named. Now there may well be others that they're going to give funding to, but those were the only ones named.
There's a lot of we will clarify this later.
Yeah, absolutely.
It'll
be interesting to see where that winds up.
I would like to see a lot more money go around the country. I think Dublin is pretty well served at this stage.
It really is.
Well, I mean, Galway is getting €15 million euro as part of its EU Capital Culture funding, at least.
Well, that's good. I mean, Galway and the has the new cinema as well there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's the smaller kind of areas that, say, Access Cinema essentially is the only ones that reach is where I'd like to see.
Where it's very hard to see.
Yeah, exactly. And I chat to people on Twitter all the time.
Like Limerick and Sligo.
Half films don't appear there ever.
Because all the screens are showing Infinity Wars.
It must be unbelievably frustrating.
Yeah.
I can imagine.
And it also includes a renaming of the Irish Film Board to Screen Ireland.
Yeah, which reflects a move towards, I think they're pitching it as a listen up millennials.
There's a plurality here. There's TV.
We're going to turn a chair around and sit on it another way.
Yeah, put the backwards cap on. The O'Radker sort of sitting there. Let's wrap.
Yeah, let's wrap. Now that the squares have gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there is, it's very much, when you read the press release, it's very much like that. We're acknowledging that people now watch media on all sorts of screens, from their phones to their laptops.
We've realized that.
I know. But in a nice segue, it seemed like Cannes hasn't. The other big news of the day is Cannes announcing its lineup, or most of its lineup, for the festival this year. So, I suppose with that segue, we should probably talk about Netflix first.
Yeah, I mean, that's the obvious big news. Netflix have pull their content.
Yeah.
That and include.
I love the irony of Netflix finally pulling their content from something.
Yeah, what I mean.
But yeah, they have basically Cannes ruled that they couldn't film any films in competition because of the law that prohibits any film in France from getting a home media or streaming release within 3 years of a cinematic release.
Which is very 1960s.
It is. It's also very French.
Yeah, and it is. They're very protective of their own.
It's worth saying France has extremely powerful distributors who have a large representation on the Cannes board.
Yeah.
And apparently underwriting a lot of this kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, well, that's the thing, is that because Okja obviously got a screening competition last year and there was big outcry about that because.
The Bambach film.
Yeah.
Aware of its stories.
Yeah.
So they got to screen last year and caused a minor controversy among those distributors who were like, those films aren't going to come to French cinemas because Netflix isn't going to put them there. So the response from Cannes was to say, if you're opening in the festival, you have to commit to a theatrical date, which means you
they're never going to do that, though.
No,
Netflix don't care because every other festival will take them.
Yeah.
Every other festival doesn't have this problem. Netflix will do what Netflix will do. Whether France ever falls in line in that regard, maybe they won't be typically perversely French to say, nah, screw it. Keep it, Netflix. And maybe they're right in their own kind of thing, but.
In a sense, they're very, very different models, even of cinephilia. You know, can attract a very different audience to Netflix. Now, there's a huge amount of overlap.
We're about to talk about one of those very big areas overlap, suspect.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where it gets really, really interesting, I think.
Which is, as you alluded to with the Orson Welles discussion earlier, Netflix will not be premiering The Other Side of the Wind at Cannes.
Which was scheduled to screen out of competition, which Cannes would be quite happy to have them show that. But Netflix have said all or nothing.
Yeah. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable response from Netflix. Because as far as Netflix are concerned, this film and films like The Irishman, they're prestige pieces. They're designed to buy the company some measure of credibility in the industry that very clearly doesn't want them there. I mean, you have Spielberg, for example, talking about how they're glorified television movies.
Yeah.
Like, the whole point of a film like...
Which is absolute nonsense.
It is absolute nonsense. It is. I agree entirely. Like, I'm not... on Spielberg's side at all.
No.
But Netflix is, I would argue, like a large part of the investment in The Other Side of the Wind and in The Irishman, you know, is as much, its subscription's fine. Yes, it is very clearly. It's a very clearly targeted financial decision.
Yeah.
But I suspect that there's also an element of this is credibility. This gives us a chance to sit down at a table and say, we made a Martin Scorsese film. What the hell did you guys do?
Yeah, and that's really interesting. And I'll talk about Scorsese just briefly. Like, The Wolf of Wall Street made, I think, 500 or 600 million worldwide. A 3-hour film, 18 certificates.
Directed by a 70-year-old film director.
Yeah, that, like, if you're a Hollywood studio and you can't stump up 100 million, 150 million for a gangster film from Scorsese, then the problem with Hollywood and
in terms of Netflix,
it's not Netflix, it's Hollywood. I mean, they don't make the films that Netflix are willing. I'm not saying Netflix is perfect, they make a lot of crap. But they're positioning themselves.
They bury it.
There's different arguments about it. But, like, they're putting the money. I was reading that one of the producers of the Wells one. They've been going around for years trying to get this. Get the rights sorted out and get the money to finish it. And nobody would touch it.
Yeah.
And nobody wants any part of it. He said Netflix is the first people to come in and A, sort the whole thing out, and B, put the money to finish it. And C, put a documentary together from the guy that made 20 Feet from Stardom. Is it a documentary? So, like, That's a big project. Like, that's a real kind of genuine
As a cinephile, how would you disagree with that?
It's
really strange to see the attitude that you get in response to Netflix pulling The Other Side of the Wind from Cannes, where there's almost like a sense of denial. It's like you've been denied like a tasty treat. It's like everybody seemed to expect to get a nice red carpet premiere at Cannes, and everybody would come out and clap, and it would be a celebration of Wells. So even during his life, you know, I mean, admittedly, he came over to Europe and he worked over here, but he was largely shunned by the industry.
Yeah.
And there's a sense almost that like bringing this film to Cannes would be a chance to make that right. And it just feels very short-sighted. It's like, Hollywood didn't want... It's not that they didn't just want Wells. They didn't want this film either.
No.
And now that it's complete, it seems hypocritical, perhaps, in some ways. I don't know. Maybe that's...
Well, Netflix will... Well, Netflix, they'll go on. They'll premiere films wherever they want to do it.
Yeah, and if you point out other festivals...
That's the reality of it. Netflix will take this film somewhere else. They'll take it to Venice or wherever they go with it.
Well, people can moan about Netflix, and there's been a lot of talk of it today, and then where films are... perfect place in the cinema or home or whatever. But the actual thing is, Netflix exists because it does a service that studios are not doing or are unwilling to do. They're doing films that are studios and buying films and acquiring films. Like, just They're making real, real partnerships with filmmakers now that seem to be developed. Scorsese has announced he's doing he's directing a documentary for them, which is it's a Canadian TV show that John Candy and stuff started on. It's like a kind of Canadian Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yes, reunion I've heard thing, right? Yeah, yeah.
There's a reunion thing being happened. And I don't really know. I'm aware of the show, but I've never seen it. It's a Screen City or something. I can't remember the name of it. But they're doing a reunion kind of thing. Everybody's coming together and everything. And Scorsese's going to direct it. And like, this is how Netflix work. They'll get somebody in to do something, and then they'll continue a relationship. That's it. And they develop a relationship with filmmakers, and they do it with TV producers as well. They've done it with Roy Murphy, done it with Shonda Rhimes. They develop very well.
They've invested and very heavily.
Spent, like, I mean, Noah Baumbach you mentioned as well. Like, he's been funded. Yeah. He did the Adam Sandler, who's on a deal. So Adam Sandler gets put in with Noah Baumbach, makes a good film, so on. So
everybody's happy.
You start building that kind of stuff, and it's all a library for them as far as they see it. Yeah. You know, and studios are just, regardless of whether you like it, at some point you're going to have to deal with it. This is where people see
the industry is shifting, and you can stand screaming at it, or you can try to adapt.
It's something really strange and disconcerting. Like, I saw an argument on Twitter about The Cloverfield Paradox, which is not a good film. But somebody's like, you know, think of the poor cinematographer who, like, worked really hard for this to be projected on a big screen, and think about now that somebody's going to be watching it on their phone. And my response is, yeah, the cinematographer's option in this case is either somebody watches on their phone on Netflix, or the film gets canned.
Yeah,
it would have been straight to video anyway. Yeah, more likely, because it got for reviews.
It's not an either-or situation.
No, it's not. Plus, you got paid.
Yeah.
Regardless of where it's screened. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not.
It's pretty much like, because that's the situation with The Irishman. It's not like there was an option where The Irishman was going to get a massive international cinematic distribution. It was always a case.
But there bloody should have been.
There should have been.
That's the problem.
Yeah, there should have been.
Like, the people that made Scorsese films should be putting money up to make more Scorsese films. Yeah.
I suspect, though, Paramount contributed to that. But somebody else should have stepped in. Warner should have stepped in. Like, it is absolutely crazy. But again, in keeping then with this theme of Khan as sort of the old man shaking his fist angrily at millennials.
I still kind of like them, though, for that, even regardless of it. Like,
well, they stick to their guns, and they're very much like, we are the Prestige Festival, we are cinema.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're going to do their thing, and fine, but there's a little bit of sense of them getting left behind in the dust.
Yes.
I don't think there's any argument you can pitch where they're coming out the winners here.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, on top of that, you also have other stuff like the selfie ban, which was a nice segue directly from the Netflix ban. It's like phones in general, whether you're watching films or taking pictures on them, none of them here, please.
And then your 8-track tapes either while you're at it.
Yeah, your boom boxes in the comments. But and obviously, Phil, the stuff like a couple of years ago, you had the controversy with the high heels, with the women on the high heels on the carpet. Yeah. And you also have, like, this year, for example, with the discussion about how there are only 3 female filmmakers in competition. Like, we will never have
Melissa Silverstein put it the last 11 years of the 20 films.
4 was the most, wasn't it?
Yeah, last 7 years. Like, it's
10%
it's
overall of
pretty
all.
Pretty appalling.
It is pretty appalling.
Fix your own house before you start.
But Khan's response to that is, we will never have a situation where we will impose equal, or we will have positive discrimination. That
positive discrimination is the term for MIU, which is just absurd.
See more films that women direct.
I'm sorry. Like, Terry, you have screened so many terrible films by men.
Yeah.
So don't talk to me about positive discrimination. That is absolutely
it's more of a wireless mesh. So there's a lot of that. But I mean, other than that, the Khan lineup is rather interesting this year. There's a bunch of established talent. There's also a bunch of interesting new directors as well.
Mm-hmm. It's I think just under 50% people of color, which is really, really good to see. They haven't necessarily got a good female balance going, but they're
Spike.
Yeah.
Spike Lee back.
Yeah,
Black Klansman.
Sounds interesting.
Sounds
I think you have to say Black Klansman.
Yeah.
The K in the middle.
Just in case
you don't.
If that title doesn't get you going.
Like, I'm there for it. That used to be the title. That's Spike Lee and I'm in the cinema for it. Like,
and starring Denzel Washington's son. It's based on the true story, I believe, about an African-American police officer who infiltrated the KKK.
I cannot wait to see this. I can't wait for autumn of 2019 when we eventually get it.
Yeah, when it's eventually released on Netflix. Because no one else
Exactly.
Netflix are going to swoop in and buy the entire competition.
That would be amazing.
But
can
they could.
They'll put it online before the festival.
Can you imagine the fuck you that would give to Cam?
You couldn't rule that out.
That would be incredible.
There's a whole bunch of other stuff. So, for example, we mentioned it last week. Following It Follows, David Robert Mitchell has Under the Silver Lake coming out, starring Andrew Garfield.
I really like the trailer. It looks great. Trailer looks great.
So I'm very, very interested in that. The opening film is Everyone Knows by
Scar Farhadi.
Yeah, by Scar Farhadi.
Oh yeah, yeah. And we've got a new film from Jafar Panahi as well.
Yeah,
Which is very, very exciting.
So no, it actually it looks like quite a reasonable lineup.
A lot of representation from Asia as well.
Yes, yeah,
which I'm wondering, and this is the cynic in me that because Netflix pulled it, I wonder how many of those films would be in there.
Oh, otherwise, so like I'm
just interested. Yeah. You will never know, I guess,
because they well,
I
mean, did they have. Was it two films they were going to have in competition, or was it three?
Okay.
So I suppose it did freeze it was the
Mexican one, Roma.
Yeah, Cuarón.
So they have Hirokazu Koreeda's Shoplifters, for example, and they have Lee Chang-dong doing Burning as well, I believe, which is an adaptation of the 1992 New Yorker short story by Japanese author
Murakami, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
It's one of the rare kind of adaptations of his work.
So it looks like actually quite a good lineup.
But they might have accidentally stumbled upon it in that way, you know, that it might be a little more diverse in that regard. Still need a lot more women filmmakers.
Oh, absolutely. It's crazy to see.
There is, as you point out, a sense that sort of Cannes is sort of almost stuck in the 20th century.
But I think it is.
I know that may be part of the charm in inverted commas, but it does suggest that at some point there's going to have to be some sort of...
I think Ronan kind of said it perfectly, though. It'll be left behind in the sense that its importance will wane. Other festivals will learn from it and kind of pick up those particular things that they don't want to touch.
Mm-hmm. And, there was a point in a very, very different media landscape where having a glitzy premiere at Cannes and having your pictures in the newspapers the next day was something incredible. Yeah, and it got the word out early, and then the film eventually arrived and people had heard about it for so long. But now there's just such a short cycle, and you have to adapt. And if they're not going to adapt at all,
I remember 15, 16 month waits from Cannes films.
Yeah.
It's kind of madness.
Well, there is even now. I mean, like...
Yeah, no, there just is. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking, for example, of... what's the name of that film we were talking about a little while ago about the guy in the avalanche?
Force Majeure,
for example. I remember hearing about almost 2 years before I saw it at the Dublin Film Festival.
Yeah.
Which means it was almost like 2 years and 3 months before anybody else saw it, which is just absurd.
Yeah.
And at that point, the film almost feels... Because the thing happens where you have various critics putting it on the film of the year list, and 2 years later you see it and you're like, that's an old film. Why is that getting a re-release?
That was my big issue with it. It was a fantastic film. That was
terrific.
It was a really great film, but by the time I'd seen it, I had like 2 years of everybody telling me it was going to change my life.
Yeah.
I was like, it was really good,
but
it didn't quite change my life.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. But, then... Also, possibly the Dublin Film Science Fiction Film Festival.
Yes.
On 2 weeks' time.
Which has some very exciting looking things. I'm really, really thrilled to see Let the Corpses Tan in there. Yeah. New film from Helene Cattett and Bruno Forzani, who previously made Amur and The Strange Colour of Your Body's Tears, both of which I love.
I've seen The Strange Colour of Your Body's Tears, which blew me away. Yeah. I'm not sure I'd say I love it, but my God, was I impressed by it. I haven't put it together in the same director, because I was talking to Ron the other day. It looks great, and I've heard people talk about it. It's excellent.
I've got my ticket for it now.
I have not, because I'm too lazy, but I will.
The Strange Colour of Your Body's Tears is one of those. It's like one of the most incredible theatre experiences I've ever had. I saw it in a 5,000 person auditorium.
Good Lord!
Yeah, it was astonishing. It's such a visual, sound, it was a gigantic screen.
For the record, I think the only time I've ever been in a 5,000 seater cinema was when I was at the Siegfried in New York, and I was one of three people there watching Spectre before it closed. It was very
That's an experience in itself.
I was the only person up on the balcony. I could have done my Hugh Jackman style Greatest Showman number, and nobody would have cared.
That sounds tragic and brilliant at the same time.
It was only a few months before it closed. Its last screening was, I think, of The Force Awakens 2 months later.
Ah.
But it's something to be in a cinema that size, even empty.
Yeah, no doubt.
But the film festival has a whole host of other films on, including, speaking of films that are delayed and we've heard about long before they've actually been screened, Marjorie Crime, which I'm actually very interested in.
The John Hamm... and other people who I can't remember, is it?
Tim Robbins, Gina Davis, and Lois Smith as well.
I like Gina Davis. It's good to see her kind of back in stuff.
Yeah, and well, she had a couple of TV shows, didn't she, as well?
Back in films, I mean.
Okay, Commander in Chief, I think it was.
Yeah, I never saw it.
Cool. And also then a whole host of anniversary screenings as well.
So yeah, they've got a nice mix of things. They've got Akira.
The Fly as well, and The Beast, is it 50,000 pounds or... 20,000.
Some amount of fathoms.
It's pretty deep.
Fathom how deep it's from.
Yeah,
I like it.
Pretty deep beast.
Cool. And then finally,
Big news week.
Oh, the ADIF is finally coming to a close as well.
Oh, yeah,
4 years after starting.
The 25th is the final screening, it's 2 days before release, Delinquencies.
Those poor volunteers have been on call for the last 8 weeks,
just waiting for the call that never comes.
It's like that little bit of trivia you hear every now and then, that the Second World War didn't officially end until Germany reunified.
It's like, the Audi Dublin International Film Festival hasn't...
It'd be great quiz question in the Film Fest 10 years ago. Which Dublin Film Festival started in 1 year and ended in another?
So The Delinquent Season is having its premiere in the lighthouse of Marco Rowe's directorial and cinematic debut, or cinematic directorial debut, which is The Delinquent Season. So that'll be interesting. I think there may even be some tickets on sale if people are still interested.
Go do it. I probably won't. When is it on?
The 25th, whatever
Wednesday
that is.
Week.
Okay.
So 2 weeks from yesterday.
Who knows? Maybe I'll be there.
That's a wonderful commitment there from Jay.
I have a ticket for it, but I actually have something else now.
Ah, well, there, your problems, Jay's, the thanks, solution sir. To Jay's problems, so offers itself.
I wasn't aware I had any problems.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rome.
All right, with that in mind, then, let's segue neatly into the top 10. At number 10, Black Panther.
Still hanging on in there. Probably last week, maybe. And we hang on for a week.
Hey, let's make nearly €3 million at the Irish box
That's
office.
Pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, it's done all right, hasn't it?
Deservedly so. It will still be playing in cinemas when Infinity War comes out, which is astounding.
Does that usually? I presume that doesn't usually happen.
No, no.
Have they overlapped?
They're normally structured so that they don't. Like it's not. Yeah. You have the whole media release of the last one.
You probably get a quarter, don't you? Probably.
Yeah. That's it. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's it. So,
well, what are they on now? 3 a year.
Four, I think.
Are they up to four?
Well, it depends on whether or not you count Spider-Man Homecoming. Yeah. They typically have 3 to 4 a year, which means, you crank them out almost a quarter.
Yeah.
So, for example, it's going to be this, it's going to be the Infinity War, it's going to be Ant-Man and Wasp, and it's going to be Marvel. Isn't Captain Marvel or she?
Is that this year?
It might be early next year.
I may go to see that one, but the others can go away.
All right, then.
Be honest, Rob. Yeah. Be honest.
Pull your punches there. Pull your punches. Somehow I feel like Marvel aren't quaking in
the face. Brie Larson is the only thing that can talk me into seeing these movies. And also, incredible box office and great word of mouth for Black Panther.
Peer pressure. It's fantastic. Yeah. Number 9, speaking of great word of mouth, Michael Insight, which is great.
Ah, yes. I went to see this and I think... No, Emma hadn't seen it last week either, but you two were... not reserved on it, but you had your reservations. I have to say, I went to see it, and I really loved it. I think more than both of you. I agree that there is a certain sort of construction to the narrative, the way it goes later in the film, but I think that's kind of partially the point, in that there's an inevitability to this.
I agree.
I was really, really impressed by it. It's got such... an incredible grasp of its visual language, the way it communicates all of this ideas of sort of entrapment, imprisonment within a system and a society. Yeah, absolutely. And my God, that performance is incredible. Dafoe Flynn.
He's great, isn't he?
I was really shocked afterwards to see it's his second performance, both with Barry.
Barry, he did I Used to Live Here. Right?
Yeah, he was in
I Used to Live Here previously. He's got such control, and it's very strange, depending on the way he's framed scene to scene, he can look a lot older and younger.
Yeah,
it shifts remarkably depending on the lighting that's put.
Well, you've seen I Used to Live Here as well.
I've since gone back and seen I Used to Live Here. I hadn't seen it
that
before.
That kind of final shot.
I Used to Live Here had a straight, because I know you had mentioned that you absolutely adore I Used to Live Here and you weren't as impressed as Michael Insight.
I really liked it. I did like it, but a couple of issues with it.
Yeah.
Whereas I didn't really have any issues with I Used to Live Here. That was kind of my...
Going back and watching I Used to Live Here, which I hadn't seen before, I spent the first half of the film, I suppose, kind of thinking it's very down and dirty, which adds to its strengths in a lot of ways. Michael Inside is, there's a lot more professional age.
There's more money, and it's more experience.
Yeah.
Like, it's a more experienced filmmaker.
And he's got, we should say, Tom Comerford is the cinematographer on that one, who also shot Love Eternal, which similarly was like absolutely gorgeous film. He's really, really great cinematographer.
Yeah.
I was so struck by that, Michael Inside. I Used to Live Here doesn't have that. It's a lot more rough and ready, which is a good thing in some ways. I wasn't quite as with it as I had been with Michael Inside until it approaches the end, and it's got that absolutely staggering final shot that for the first time, I actually think for the first time since God, I don't even know when at this point. It's the first time in a very, very long time the film has kind of had an amazing physical impact on me, right? I felt really drained, but I was like, I have to go to bed now. I am done with this day.
I remember reading Donald Clark's review of a review of it, and he mentioned something really interesting that which I liked, because I was rereading stuff. I was rereading stuff after watching it again, just in terms of writing an article, and he says something really interesting about the scenes where she goes into the city. It's like, it's almost like a mini odyssey.
And
out of the city. It's like a team fight. And it's unbelievably well constructed on
and
nothing.
The film does very well to communicate what for any of us going into the city is just an everyday experience. For her, that's like the most significant experience of her life.
Yeah. She's young.
And
in that way.
It's beautifully communicated in the way the film is shot. Yeah. I think Barry, having seen those two films, and I haven't seen the documentary he did for his Ballymun Lullaby. He's got an amazing command of the camera.
It's
really, really,
and you can
remarkable.
See the trust the as actors have in him as well. Like it's you can feel that, and I think I kind of mentioned when I was writing about it that there's a kind of, you can see where he gets compared to Loach and Lee in the sense that that kind of workshopping with actors and stuff. There's a kind of almost community
trust
feel on the film and
trust
and stuff, and that makes a huge difference, particularly when you're working on low budgets where there's not extra time to keep shooting stuff. You really want to know
what you're doing, when you're doing.
There's a real sense of these characters existing beyond the film itself.
I think Waste Labor was like a few thousand. Like, it cost practically nothing.
Wow.
And the effect they get.
I think it's incredible.
I was left in tatters.
It's great. But, it's good to see Michael Inside doing well.
We should actually mention that Jay has an article in this month's Scenario.
I do. And it was one of those very pleasurable ones to write on Barry Yenna's films.
Perfect. At number 8, A Wrinkle in Time, which is actually doing surprisingly well.
Isn't it?
Hanging on.
Yeah, it's doing better here than it did in the States, I think.
Which is quite impressive.
It's kind of weirdly slightly hanging on the States as well a little bit. It's sprouted a little more legs than they thought it would maybe after the first week or two.
It's not going to be the greatest show. No. Like, to be absolutely clear and to manage expectations there. Let's pause for a moment to acknowledge the loss of the greatest showman from the
Don't worry, he'll be back next week.
I almost saw it.
Yeah.
saw it wrong, and it was a tragic.
Near miss situation.
I think it's effectively us that's knocked it out.
Yeah.
Had we gone.
Yeah, we would have bumped it in and by my
it was one ticket away.
Lord.
That's
sad. That makes me sad.
It is good to see A Wrinkle in Time holding on, because it's a better movie than its reputation or than the response to it has garnered. It's messy, it's clunky, it's awkwardly paced, but it's very beautifully shot and very well constructed, and has a wonderful sense of wonder, as I think Jay mentioned last week.
I think some of the things about it were that it was a little too earnest and a little too wondrous and a little too young and kind of optimistic and all the ways that...
Well, and I do think there were some structural problems in the film.
I'm not suggesting for a second that it's perfect. Like, I mean, I think even the people that liked it had some issues with it. It's not...
But it is much better than its reputation.
Yeah.
At number 7, Isle of Dogs.
I haven't got to this.
I was going to say, someone who likes cats, I was quite curious to see what you made of this.
Oh, my God. I have heard in advance that it is not necessarily nice to cats, which is part of the reason I think that I haven't gone.
Oh, just so we're clear on this.
I haven't seen it.
Watch The Prestige instead. It's a much better cat movie. But I Love Dogs is great. And it's fantastic because every time you say the title, you're saying I Love Dogs.
Which is terrific. And I've just started to say that. I'm saying those three words now instead. I really want to catch it, and I think I probably will find the time this weekend. I'm looking forward to it a lot.
Very Wes Anderson-y.
I'm a Wes Anderson fan. I'll go catch it.
And it is very much late Wes Anderson as well, and feels nice that this is sort of like a bookend with the Fantastic Mr. Fox. At number 6, Duck Duck Goose. I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that none of us have seen this, despite the fact it grossed over €111,000
this week
at the box office this week.
Not
kids are off
me,
school.
It wasn't.
You gotta take
kids still off school. Do they ever go to school?
Kids these days with their rock and roll.
I'm gonna wave my fist angrily if you can't see it.
Nintendo DS's.
So it's currently closing on €500,000, which is not bad for a film that I don't think anybody
ever has seen.
Yeah. I'm gonna make an animated movie. Just there's got to be worth €500,000. Like, literally anybody can do, as far as I can see, and just makes a fortune.
We need to workshop.
Just release it while the kids are off, which is always.
Let's do it. Let's just do it. Let's not talk about it.
Yeah, let's make this happen. Cartoon Salon, you have our email address. Yeah. Cartoon Saloon. It's Cartoon Saloon.
Cartoon Salon.
That's actually a hairdresser for animated characters.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Where Marge gets it done.
At number 5, Love, Simon, which is nice.
Good to see. Number 5 is pretty good entry point. I guess I was a little negative on it last week, just talking about ideas of representation. I should clarify. I really like it. It's really good. Really, really funny script. And it's really important. I think one thing that I was quite moved by was that if you look at the Letterboxd page for it, it's just completely taken up with these stories of kids who've gone to see the film and went home and came out to their parents, this kind of thing. And that really, really does matter, I have to say. Like, if I had seen this film 20 years ago, I would have been like, holy shit, there's me on the screen. Yeah. This is not something good. And that it's taken 20 years is really frustrating.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we should have seen something like this 20 years ago, ideally. But, you know, we're here and let's be glad for that, I suppose.
I mean, one of the most compelling arguments for Love, Simon, and I don't mean to diminish the film in any way, shape, or form, is that it's proven that it's possible to make a perfectly average film that just happens to have a gay lead.
No, absolutely.
And that's a huge step forward. Like, making an adequate film, not making an exceptional film, not having to make, like, a prestige film, not having to make, like, a film that redefines...
Well, it's a studio is putting it out there, and it is a matter of economics. A studio has weighed this up when this is financially viable. But the fact that it is financially viable tells you a lot about the kind of society that we now live in.
Which is great.
One thing else worth saying is that Jennifer Garner is in it as Simon's mother, and she's fantastic.
Garner's really good.
I've been hot and cold on Garner before. There was that film, which I can't remember the name of, where she was carving butter that I saw a couple of years ago. That was... Okay,
counterpoint.
Yeah.
13 going on 30.
She's great in a lot of things.
Let's go back to the carving butter story. There's a film where
she's like a small town woman in America who carves butter at like a butter carving competition. It's like a really bad Christopher Guest film. About butter carving.
Okay.
It's bizarre.
I'm getting that Jay really, really wants to know.
I reviewed it many years ago, and I can't for the life. Yeah, of course.
Of course,
I can't for the life.
It didn't garner much
praise.
It's actually called Butter, I believe.
Oh,
which is quite
the butter film. Yeah,
the titular
the butter film. For many years, Laura Pickler, yes, Pickler, has relished the prestige and admiration afforded her as wife of Iowa's longtime butter carving champion Bob, played by Ty Burrell. When Bob is pressured to retire from the competition so that somebody else has a chance at victory, Laura decides to enter the contest herself. It gets even better. But when three formidable opponents also enter the fray, Laura vows to win at any cost, including recruiting her stupid ex-boyfriend, Hugh Jackman, for a bit of sabotage.
Olivia Wilde, Jennifer Garner, Hugh Jackman, Alicia Silverstone.
Yeah. It's legitimately terrible, and as I say, it's the kind of thing Christopher Guest would have made as a parody, but it has no sense of humour whatsoever, and it's just like Jennifer Garner giving it her all, carving butter.
Sonan,
did you miss the fact that the film is said to be a satire of the 2008 Democratic presidential primary?
I didn't miss that, because I was pounded over the head with it. It's... Oh, God. It's
somebody smacks their face and goes, oh, Bala!
So we won't be seeing that. Anyway, that was a nice segue. No? Yeah. I like those kind of things. Yeah.
No, it really buttered us up for the next film, which is Blockers, which is surprisingly good, directed by Kate Cannon, who I seem to have forgotten last week, also co-wrote all the Pitch Perfect films.
Okay,
really, really love Pitch Perfect. Let's say the second one, the better. But
well, no, the first one's amazing.
Great.
The first one's
really great.
Second one is so-so. Haven't seen the third one yet.
Neither have I.
But yeah, so I mean, if we all pitch in, we can buy a ticket. But Blockers is another interesting film. It's a very standard kind of gross-out comedy. But it's interesting in terms of how it subtly embraces sort of a feminist and progressive perspective in that it's very consciously a film that's aware of the more uncomfortable aspects of its story about parents trying to stop their daughters from having sex at prom. At number three, it's Ready Player One, which I'm sure that both of you have seen and are very enthusiastic about.
Immediately after the last podcast, I rushed out and went home and thought about how I'm not going to see this film.
Hey! It's a nice little embarrassing
moment.
Yeah. Spielberg was leaning forward there.
Listening to the Scandal podcast, it's like between the five other films that he's working on at the moment while in post-production.
I have nothing against the idea of seeing this in particular. I tend not to massively enjoy late Spielberg blockbuster stuff.
Do you want something to be against it? Oh, 2 hours and 20 minutes, right? How's that? That'll do it, surely.
If it makes you feel any better, it doesn't feel any longer than 2:10, Jay.
No.
Wait, you say so? Yeah, I know, he would have been all over that. Yeah. Again, it works best when it's a typical Spielberg film. It works worst when it's very much fan servicey. Here's this thing you recognize, eating this other thing that you recognize, inside this bigger thing that you recognize.
See, even that fills me with horror. I can't describe that description even.
Yeah, no, there's something... And it's as we discussed last week, it's how self-aware is Spielberg this? In a sense, he is aware, but he's not willing to push it as far as it needs to go.
Yeah.
And speaking of horrors that fill you with dread, Jay, A Quiet Place at number two.
I haven't seen, I will see this and 120 BPM are on my list to see.
I heard that it's the second cheapest film ever to gross above 50 million opening at the US box office, which is pretty incredible.
Horror is serious business.
One of the highest grossing original films in quite a while as well. It's phenomenal.
They don't do those anymore.
It's done really well, and apparently, I can vouch from my own experience, but I was glad to hear like people talking about it on Twitter and people talking about it in articles, stuff like that. Seeing the film is an interesting experience because obviously it gives nothing away to reveal the premise. It's monsters that punch you based on sound. What you see is the audience passively becoming sort of complicit in this. Yeah. You see the audience being more mindful of their reactions, so of their chewing.
Gently given cinematic behaviour.
That's it. I would argue it very consciously, like, and again, not to go down the tangent of It Follows, Lights Out or whatever, but it literalizes the horror movie-going experience. It's a film about watching horror films in the same way that Lights Out is like, this thing can only move if you don't look at it. So don't look away from the screen no matter what you do. Whereas on the other hand, this is like, this can only haunt you if you make a sound. So don't scream no matter what horrible thing you see on screen.
I would die very quickly. I'd find it very difficult. I'm so bored of this shit.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm walking through a forest, I like to sing sometimes. So I'm gone.
I
have the shower.
Shut the fuck up, sing around it. You're giving us all away.
And speaking of unfathomable horrors, at number one, Peter Rabbit.
Which has made almost as much as Black Panther.
Yep, it's going to make more than Black Panther. Like, 2.8 million.
It has James Corden.
How did it come along and do that? Well,
the
none
kids
of us
are on
paying
holidays.
Attention.
Yeah.
How did they go see this and Duck Duck Goose? Where are they getting all this money?
I love that this is the podcast where you can hear Ronan turn into a Cannes Film Festival programmer. kids, they probably took selfies and didn't wear respectable attire either.
Popcorn.
An astounding success story.
That's incredible.
300,000 this weekend.
Oh, stop.
And this is what, its third or fourth weekend in release?
There is not enough money in the world to get me to see that.
How does that compare to, like, other kids' films that have opened around similar periods? Is it doing especially well? Because I'm trying to think, like, what's going on?
No, well, it's always been that way. That's why if you look at...
Oh, no,
like
I know these things always do well, but that seems like...
You've got to keep in mind, Alice in Wonderland is, like, the biggest hit. That's basically Tim Burton got a ticket to ride based on Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
You also have stuff like The Jungle Book, which opened around the same time 2 years ago. It was a complete monster that everybody forgot existed and was actually quite good, to be fair to it.
It was all right, actually.
You have, obviously, I think the Despicable Me movies typically open later in the year, but Minions and stuff like that,
they're like
all gobbling and all consuming.
Yeah. I've never
but they're that. Very, very clearly merchandisable. Whereas Peter Rabbit, not so much.
But he has a cool denim jacket.
Think about the Minions ones I've said. Like, I'm rarely that fussed about box office things. It interests me to a certain point, but but I remember having a look at those films. And interestingly, I think the sequels to kind of Despicable Me, the Minions films, kind of, they got less. They cost less to produce and kept making more money. So it's kind of this, we'd strip it back and we'd keep making over billions.
Yeah.
So I think they made like 4 billion or something.
Progressively introduced characters that are really easy to make into little toys.
Are merchandisable. That's the main goal here.
These things are trailers.
Let's write that animation. That's merchandisable.
I'm surprised that, for example, Tic Tac haven't just started releasing packets of lemon Tic Tacs. You know, just by coincidence, assuming that they'd be more brandable and merchandisable. All right then, so that is the top 10. Let's move into talking about the films that are in wide release this week. It's a much shorter list than last week. Last week was a complete bloodbath. It's worth noting how few of the films actually got in.
Because,
I mean, you know, I Killed Giants only made something like $8,000, which is peanuts, which is very, very sad to see. But anyway, so opening this week we have Custody, directed by Xavier Legrand,
which is getting terrific reviews.
Yeah.
I really like the look of this. I'm very excited to see it. I'll be catching it this weekend.
I've like 10 films to see. How am I supposed to see these things?
Well, do what the kids do. Take a week off.
Yeah. Jay, go on holidays.
I'm going on holidays. I will not be able to see any films. This is It's the worst holiday.
The non-film holiday. Also, opening this week is Ken Wardrop's Making the Grade, the documentary about people learning to play musical instruments. Apparently, it's very moving. I've heard great things.
I like Wardrop stuff. He has a very particular style, and it's the kind of thing that you go and you see with a big crowd, and it's lovely, and everybody is very moved, and you know, it's a nice thing to go see. I think it's going to do very well. Locks Up's Away in Ireland.
Oh, but it's also, I think it'll chase the Grey Pound as well.
Yeah.
Which, like, these Wardrop films tend to kind of get an older audience in general, kind of thing. So I'd say, but
and I mean, and that's clear until the Guernsey Potato Peel Society movie next.
That's
next
such week. A weird title name.
I think I mangled it there, but yeah.
Guernsey Literary and Potato
there
Peel.
There we go.
The
yeah.
Well, glad have you know.
He says he takes out a tattered copy of the novel. Yeah.
I love Guernsey Potato Peel and literature. So.
The two together was an irresistible combination. The monster release of the week, in all sense of the word, is Rampage, directed by Brad Peyton, who directed San Andreas and starring The Rock.
You've seen this, haven't you, Darren?
Yeah.
You always see these, don't you?
Is it?
Yeah, it's not good. Yeah.
Not even fun, bad.
No, it has moments. Like, it starts out like Kong Skull Island, and then it morphs into like the 2014 Godzilla, which is just an unholy mess.
Yeah, it's not a good film.
That's it.
It works best when the movie embraces the bizarre, like, bestial bromance that exists between The Rock and his best friend, George, who happens to be a several thousand pound gorilla. There are moments...
So, what you're telling me is it's Any Which Way We Can.
Pretty much.
For the 20th century.
It's Godzilla. But it is, like, it works best when The Rock, who was, you know, maybe not the greatest actor of his generation, but has this wonderful...
He's the biggest star.
Quite literally. But he also has this ability to convey empathy and compassion, which works remarkably well. So when you see him shout, "No, George!" or "Go, George!" or "I just want to know what's happening to my friend!" You have this sort of weird attachment to the CGI play. There's a moment where Jeffrey Dean Morgan, who is playing smarmy...
The poor man's Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, playing a smarmy government agent whose primary function is to obstruct the plot, shows up, and after being really smarmy, notices the intense emotional attraction that exists between The Rock and the gorilla named George, and says, in perhaps the most earnest delivery of Jeffrey Dean Morgan's entire career, "About your friend, I'm truly sorry." And it's just this wonderful sense of earnestness at the heart of the film where you really believe. There are moments where two separate characters ask The Rock, "So how come you don't like people?" There are moments where it seems like it's going to be a Gonzo B-movie treat, and then there are moments when it just turns horrible. Its climax is like the Man of Steel 9/11 times 1,000 nonsense that you come to expect from blockbusters, which makes you think, like, Kong Skull Island's biggest innovation wasn't, you know, Apocalypse Now in the 70s setting with, like, the pop music video aesthetic. It was in moving the climax to a, you know, jungle island where you could destroy stuff that wasn't buildings and wasn't going to evoke the footage of 9/11. It's not a good film, unfortunately. Although it
kind of want to see it
after
sold it to me.
Yeah, I've done this thing over the last couple of years where I don't really keep up with studio production news and I don't watch trailers, so that, you know, if something comes along and I see the trailer in the cinema, I can be surprised and be like, "Oh, I'll go see that." So this is pretty much the first I've heard of this film at all, and that was incredible.
Me too, right?
How does this? What?
And
what?
How does all of this fit together? It's fantastic. There's a moment where, yeah, the Rock genuinely cradles the ape. It's like,
I'm not going to blockbusters anymore. You go and tell me about it. I like this a lot
better. It's a better film.
The experience is somewhat more moving.
My mental image is, this is my Morven Keller.
This is your other side of the wind. It's like, yeah.
Have you seen this film? Yes. No, you haven't. Darren just told you about it.
I've seen it, damn it.
And I love that it also incorporates the recurring Brad Peyton and Dwayne Johnson motif of The Rock stealing an emergency helicopter to go rescue his friend, despite the
he
fact
does
that
love a helicopter, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Despite the fact it could be used to save random strangers instead. But it's so fantastic. I really hope the next movie they do, whatever it is, and continues that sort of subtle...
Darren, this sounds great. I really don't see what the problem is.
This isn't the film where there was a poster where he was jumping and people did all sorts of trigonometry on it.
Oh, no, that was Skyscraper.
Has that come out?
No.
Oh. We've got more to look forward to.
Yeah.
Or we're going to do the podcast that week.
Because I will definitely have seen that.
Yeah, I like that. The giant 10,000-pound albino gorilla was too much for me, but Dwayne Johnson's improbable skyscraper jumping has me
I want to see that lunge. I want to see how they do.
Stay tuned, listeners. And finally, out this week, we also have Truth or Dare, which is the new Blumhouse film. In fact, it's being sold as from the studio that brought you Get Out.
Amazing, isn't it? What, Get Out's retooled the whole bloody thing?
No, it is. But I mean, that's it. You've got the Blumhouse as auteur, which is a really bizarre concept.
But they've positioned themselves accidentally or otherwise in that way.
To be fair, Jason Blumhouse has made a conscious effort.
It's not his actual name.
It's Jason Blum, isn't it?
Kidding me.
Jason Blum, sorry.
Otherwise, his company would be called Blumhouse.
He's got to be Blumhouse from now on. I am never calling him Jason Blum. Yeah. Sorry, he's Jason Blumhouse. I'm sorry, that's...
But yes, okay.
Mr. Blumhouse, great to meet you. I love all your work.
But yeah, he's actually, to be fair, he has engaged and tried to make sort of socially relevant movies, which is it's commendable and stuff like that. It's interesting to see.
Also, there's a dollar in it, though. I mean, the small budget versus. But he was still doing it.
Like, one of the strangest moments of last year in the cinema was going to see that Reese Witherspoon movie from Nancy Meyers' daughter. I can't remember the name of it. I think it's Starting Over or something like that. But they have a character who's very clearly meant to be Jason Blum, and it feels really mean-spirited. Oh. He's a horror director who's like, I'm going to make this visionary thing, but don't worry, it's going to involve lots of stabbing and blood. It's going to be fantastic. It's going to be a commentary on America, but also knives. And it's like, and you're like, you're watching this and you're thinking, okay, you had no idea that Get Out was going to be released after you did this.
Yeah, of course.
But at the same time, it's a really patronizing and condescending sort of, look at that.
See how you like it, Blumhouse.
But maybe the character was named Blumhouse.
It's not Blumhouse. It's not the same person as the composite.
But as we've sort of covered, I don't think any of us have actually seen Truth or Dare or have any idea what it's about.
No, I presume it's about some sort of... I think I've read something about it. It's like Final Destination, but you guess Truth or Dare, and you have to pick one or do
like
die.
Like
a
Ouija board, Truth or Dare.
Wasn't there like a film called Ouija a couple of years ago?
Yes, there was.
Just covered this whole thing, no?
But I mean, there was also The Exorcist as well, to be fair. The Exorcist was a great advertisement.
Now, there's a great
there's your tie-in movie.
Oh,
make that, Blumhouse.
I wasn't a big fan of The Exorcist, but we won't...
Really?
Yeah.
How?
Darren!
When did you first see it?
I was about, say, 18, 19?
I said 12, I think.
Yeah, I was 12. I saw it on DVD at 12. And it's one of those interesting films where watching it now, it doesn't scare me, but it has like a very direct connection to the memories of being terrified at that age.
Quite still scares me.
I have that with The Shining, too. I watched The Shining far too young, and I sort of see it, and I remember the terror of that.
I'm still terrified by The Shining. The Shining hits me on a more elemental level.
I had 3 older brothers, so I saw pretty much every film. It's the same. Like 18 rated film by the time I was 15, pretty much everything that's like including my bootleg driller killers and stuff like that. Like, you know,
my favorite memory, I watched The Shining at the age of 8. That's one of my childhood memories.
No shit. Right up bloody there, elevators for the rest of your life.
Right up there with reading, was it American Psycho at the age of 10? Because my parents were like, he wants to watch the movie, but the movie's over 18. That may have scarred me. So, and I feel like after watching that and hearing so much about The Exorcist, because The Exorcist obviously, I think I saw it when it got re-released in the 2000s?
I saw it then as well. I remember.
Yeah, and by that stage I just heard so much about it that it was almost...
No, I think it was 98 actually.
Maybe
it was later, I don't know. Anyway.
Alright, so it would have been 11 or 12, so basically 18.
It's about as close as it gets to a consensus greatest horror ever, really, isn't it?
The Shining, ones tussling for it.
Yeah.
I got a pitch, Martyrs.
Silence of the Lambs.
Martyrs.
Martyrs is my pick for certainly the top three horrors.
Yeah, same here.
I could not possibly comment. Audition's great.
Audition
gave me nightmares.
Audition is absolutely fantastic.
The week after I got a TV, I convinced my parents to let me have a TV in the room, promising that I would not watch anything on a school night. After, I turned it off at 10 o'clock, I was, 11 years old.
We've all made those false promises.
Oh, yeah. Film 4, Channel 4, as it was back then, ran a Japanese horror season. So it opened with The Ring at the age of 11, at which point I think... On my new TV. So I sealed the press shut that night and slept with my back against it. And the next week, having apparently not learned my lesson, I went back and watched Audition. And if anybody hasn't watched Audition, it starts out as a rom-com.
It starts quiet, gently, almost romantic love story before becoming something
and
else.
And it lulls you into a false sense of security that, like, I'm not sure I could handle now. But at the age of 11, I was like, this is kind of cute and fun.
Kitty, 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 kitty.
Yeah.
What's in the bag?
Sorry, that was very Seven.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I was at Twitter.
But anyway, so if people are looking to find you guys online, where can they find you?
You will find me giving out about absolutely everything at Baron Ronan on Twitter.
Embracing his inner canon.
And you'll find me agreeing with him.
There's also Scanon is releasing Cinerin, hopefully this week as well.
Yes, I think next day or so. Yeah.
With a focus on Michael and Syed. There'll be an article from Jason as well, covering obviously Frank Berry's career retrospective. There'll be interviews as well, and I believe there's also an article on Wes Anderson from My Love Dogs, with Stacey Grouton, who wasn't able to join us this evening.
Yes, I look forward to it. It's going to be a terrific bumper edition, as you say.
Woohoo!
All right, take it easy, guys, and we'll see you next week. Bye!
Bye-bye.
I never forget the first moment when I walked in Curious Cinema. I was hooked from there on.